Chapter 13. So strong was this new feeling that Sean could hate even Garrick. He did not hate for long, though. Sean's anger and his hatred were quick things, with flames like those of a fire in dry grass, hot and high but soon burnt out, and afterwards the ashes dead with no smouldering. Waite was away when it happened. For 3 consecutive years, Waite Courtney had been nominated for the chairmanship of the Beef Growers Association, and each time he had stood down. He was human enough to want the prestige the office carried with it, but he was also sensible to the fact that his farm would suffer from his frequent absences. Sean and Garrick had been working for 2 years when the annual election of office-bearers came around again. The night before Waite left for the meeting in Peter Maritzburg, he spoke to Ada. "I had a letter from Bernard last week, my dear." He was standing before the mirror in their bedroom, trimming his beard. "They insist that I stand for the chair this year."
"Very wise of them," said Ada. "They'd have the best man if you did."
Waite frowned with concentration as he snipped at his whiskers. She believed so unquestioningly in him that he seldom doubted himself. Now, looking at his face in the mirror, he wondered how much of his success was owed to Ada's backing.
"You can do it, Waite."
Not a challenge, not a question, but a calm statement of fact. When she said it, he believed it. He laid the scissors down on the chest of drawers and turned to her. She sat cross-legged on the bed in a white nightgown. Her hair was down in a dark mass around her shoulders.
"I think Sean can look after things here," she said. And then quickly, "And of course Gary."
"Sean's learning fast," Waite agreed.
"Are you going to take the job?"
Waite hesitated.
"Yes."
He nodded, and Ada smiled.
"Come here."
She held out her hands to him. Sean drove Waite and Ada to the station at Ladyburg. At the last minute, Waite had insisted that she go with him, for he wanted her to be there to share it with him. Sean put the luggage into the coach and waited while they talked with the small group of cattlemen who were going up to the meeting. The whistle blew and the travellers scattered to their compartments. Ada kissed Sean and climbed up. Waite stayed a second longer on the platform.
"Sean, if you need any help, go across to Mr. Erasmus at Lion Cop. I'll be back on Thursday." "I won't need any help, Pa."
Waite's mouth hardened.
"Then you must be God. He's the only one who never needs help," Waite said harshly. "Don't be a bloody fool. If you run into trouble, ask Erasmus."
He climbed up after Ada. The train jerked, gathered speed, and ran out towards the escarpment. Sean watched it dwindle, then he walked back to the buggy. He was the master of the Hunus Corral, and he liked the feeling. The small crowd on the platform was dispersing, and out of it came Anna.
"Hello, Sean."
She had on a green cotton dress that was faded with washing. Her feet were bare. She smiled with her small white teeth and watched his face.
"Hello, Anna."
"Aren't you going up to Peter Marriottsburg?"
"No, I've got to look after the farm."
"Oh."
They waited in silence, uncomfortable before so many people. Sean coughed and scratched the side of his nose.
"Anna, come on, we've got to get home,"
one of her brothers called from in front of the ticket office, and Anna leaned toward Sean.
"Will I see you on Sunday?" she whispered.
"I'll come if I can. But I don't know. I've got to look after the farm."
"Please try, Sean."
Her face was earnest.
"I'll be waiting for you." I'll take some lunch and wait all day. Please come, even if it's only for a little while.
All right, I'll come.
Promise?
Promise.
She smiled with relief. I'll wait for you on the path above the waterfall.
She turned and ran to join her family, and Sean drove back to Thihuna's corral. Garrick was lying on his bed reading.
I thought Pa told you to get on with the branding of those new cattle we bought on Wednesday.
Garrick laid down his book and sat up.
I told Zama to keep them in the corral till you got back.
Pa told you to get on with it.
You can't keep them there all day without feed or water.
I hate branding, muttered Garrick.
I hate it when they moo like that as you burn them. And I hate the stink of burning hair and skin. It gives me a headache.
Well, someone's got to do it. I can't. I've got to go down and mix new dip into the tanks for tomorrow.
Sean was losing his temper.
Hell, Gary, why are you always so damned helpless?
I can't help it.
I can't help it if I've only got one leg.
Garrick was close to tears again. The reference to his leg had the desired effect. Sean's temper steadied instantly.
I'm sorry.
Sean smiled his irresistible smile.
I'll tell you what. I'll do the branding, you fix the tanks. Get the drums of dip loaded onto the Scotch cart. Take a couple of the stable boys with you to help. Here are the keys of the storeroom.
He tossed the bunch onto the bed beside Garrick.
You'll be finished before dark.
At the door, he turned.
Gary, don't forget to do all six tanks, not just the one near the house.
So Garrick loaded six drums of dip onto the Scotch cart and went off down the hill. He was home well before dark. The front of his breeches was stained with a dark, tarry chemical, and some of it had soaked into the leather of his single riding boot. As he came out of the kitchen into the passage, Sean shouted from the study,
"Hey, Gary, did you finish them?"
Garrick was startled. Waite's study was a sacred place, the inner sanctum of the Thunis Corral. Even Ada knocked before going into it, and the twins went there only to receive punishment. Garrick limped along the passage and pushed open the door. Sean sat with his boots on the top of the desk and his ankles neatly crossed. He leaned back in the swivel chair.
"Pa will kill you."
Garrick's voice was shaky.
"Pa's in Peter Marriottsburg," said Sean.
Garrick stood in the doorway and looked around the room. It was the first time he had really seen it. On every previous visit, he had been too preoccupied with the violence to come, and the only item in the room he had studied closely was the seat of the big leather easy chair as he bent over the arm of it and exposed his backside to the jambok. Now he looked at the room. The walls were panelled to the ceiling. The wood was dark yellow and polished. The ceiling was fancy plaster in a pattern of oak leaves. A single lamp hung from the centre of it on a brass chain. You could walk into the fireplace of brown chipped stone, and there were logs laid ready for the match. Pipes and tobacco jar on the ledge beside the fireplace, guns in a rack along one wall. A bookcase of green and maroon leather-bound volumes, encyclopedias, dictionaries, books on travel and farming, but no fiction. There was an oil painting of Ada on the wall opposite the desk. The artist had captured a little of her serenity. She wore a white dress and carried her hat in her hand. A magnificent set of Cape Buffalo horns above the fireplace dominated the room, with their great crenellated bosses and white sweep to the tips. It was a man's room, with loose dog hairs on the leopard-skin rugs, and the presence of the man strongly there. It even smelt of weight. It was as distinctively his as the tweed coat and the terai hat that hung behind the door. Next to where Sean sat, the cabinet was open, and a bottle of brandy stood on top of it. Sean had a goblet in his hand.
"You're drinking Pa's brandy," Garrick accused.
"It's not bad." Sean lifted the glass and inspected the liquid. He took a careful sip and held it in his mouth, preparing himself to swallow. Garrick watched him with awe, and Sean tried not to blink as it went down his throat. "Would you like some?" Garrick shook his head, and the fumes came up Sean's nose and his eyes ran.
"Pa will kill you," said Garrick again.
"Sit down," ordered Sean, his voice husky from the brandy. "I want to work out a plan for the time Pa's away." Garrick advanced on the armchair, but before he reached it he changed his mind. The associations were too painful. He went to the sofa instead and sat on the edge. "Tomorrow," Sean held up one finger, "we'll dip all the cattle in the home section. I've told Zama to start bringing them in early. You did do the tanks, didn't you?" Garrick nodded, and Sean went on. "On Saturday," Sean held up his second finger, "we'll burn fire breaks along the top of the escarpment. The grass is as dry as hell up there. You take one gang and start near the falls. I'll ride down to the other end, near Frederick's Kloof." "On Sunday," Sean said, and then paused. "On Sunday, Anna."
"I want to go to church on Sunday," said Garrick quickly.
"That's fine," agreed Sean. "You go to church."
"Are you going to come?"
"No," said Sean. Garrick looked down at the sheepskin rugs that covered the floor. He didn't try to persuade Sean, for Anna would be at the service. Perhaps afterwards, if Sean wasn't there to distract her, he could drive her home in the buggy. He started a daydream and wasn't listening as Sean went on talking. In the morning it was full daylight by the time Sean reached the dip tank. He pushed a small herd of stragglers before him, and they came out through the trees and stirrup-high grass into a wide area of trampled earth around the tank. Garrick had started running cattle through the dip, and there were about 10 head already in the draining crowl at the far end, standing wet and miserable, their bodies dark with dip. Sean drove his herd through the gates of the entrance corral into the solid pack of brown bodies that were already there. In duty, slid the bars of the gate back into place to hold them. "I see you in Kosi. I see you in duty. Plenty of work today." "Plenty," agreed in duty. "Always plenty of work." Sean rode around the corral and tied his horse beneath one of the trees, then walked across to the tank. Garrick was standing by the parapet and leaning against one of the columns that supported the roof. "Hello, Gary, how's it going?"
"Fine."
Sean leaned over the parapet next to Gary. The tank was 20 feet long and 8 wide. The surface of the liquid was below ground level. Around the tank was a low wall, and over it a roof of thatch to prevent rain diluting the contents. The herd boys drove the cattle up to the edge, and each beast hesitated on the brink.
"Yuppie! Yuppie!"
screamed the herd boys, and the push of bodies behind it forced it to jump. If one was stubborn, Zama leaned over the rail of the corral, grabbed its tail, and bit it. Each beast jumped with its nose held high and its 4 feet gathered up under its chest. It disappeared completely under the oil-black surface and came up again, swimming frantically along the tank until its hooves touched the sloping bottom at the far end, and it could lumber up into the draining kraal.
"Keep them moving, Zama!" shouted Sean.
Zama grinned at him and bit with big white teeth into a reluctant tail. The ox was a heavy animal, and it splashed a drop up onto Sean's cheek as he leaned over the wall. Sean didn't bother to wipe it off. He went on watching.
"Well, if we don't get top prices for this lot at the next sale, then the buyers don't know good cattle," he said to Gary.
"They're all right," agreed Gary.
"All right? They're the fattest oxen in the district."
Sean was about to enlarge on the theme, but suddenly he was aware of discomfort. The drop of dip was burning his cheek. He wiped it off with his finger and held it up to his nose. The smell of it stung his nostrils. For a second he stared at it stupidly, and the spot on his cheek burnt like fire. He looked up quickly. The cattle in the draining kraal were milling restlessly, and as he looked, one of them staggered sideways and bumped against the railing.
"Zama!" shouted Sean, and the Zulu looked up. "Stop them! For God's sake, don't let any more through!"
There was another ox poised on the edge. Sean snatched off his hat and jumped up onto the wall. He beat the ox in the face with his hat, trying to drive it back, but it sprang out into the tank. Sean caught hold of the railing and stepped into the space it had left on the edge of the tank.
"Stop them!" he shouted. "Get the bars in! Don't let any more through!"
He spread his arms across the entrance, holding on to the railing on each side, kicking at the faces of the cattle in front of him.
"Hurry, damn you! Get the bars in!" he shouted.
The oxen pressed towards him, a wall of horned heads. Pushed forward by those behind and held back by Sean, they started to panic. One of them tried to jump over the railing. As it swung its head, its horn raked Sean's chest up across the ribs, ripping his shirt. Behind him, Sean felt the wooden bars being dropped into place, blocking the entrance to the tank, and then Zama's hands on his arm, pulling him up out of the confusion of horns and hooves. Two of the herd boys helped him over the railing, and Sean shrugged their hands off as soon as he was on the ground.
"Come on,"
he ordered, and ran to his horse.
"And go see, you are bleeding."
Blood had splodged the front of Sean's shirt, but he felt no pain. The cattle that had been through the dip were now in terrible distress. They charged about the kraal, bellowing pitifully. One of them fell, and when it got to its feet again, its legs were shaking so that it could barely stand.
"The river!" shouted Sean. "Get them down to the river! Try and wash it off! Zama, open the gate!"
The baboon stream was a mile away. One of the oxen died before they could get them out of the kraal. Another 10 before they reached the river. They died in convulsions, with their bodies shuddering and their eyes turning back into their heads. Sean drove those that remained down the bank into the river. The water was clear, and as each beast went into it, the dip washed off in a dark brown cloud.
"Stand here, Zama. Don't let them come out."
Sean swam his horse to the far bank and turned back the oxen that were trying to climb it.
"Nkosi, one is drowning,"
called Nduti, and Sean looked across the river. A young ox was in convulsions in the shallows. Its head was under water and its feet thrashed the surface. Sean slid off his horse and waded out to it. The water was up to his armpits. He tried to hold its head out and drag it to the bank.
"Help me, Nduti!"
he shouted, and the Zulu came into the river. It was a hopeless task. Each time the ox lunged, it pulled them both under with it. By the time they got the ox to the bank, it was dead. Sean sat in the mud beside the body of the ox. He was exhausted, and his lungs ached with the water he had breathed. "Bring them out, Zama," he gasped. The survivors were standing in the shallows, or swimming in aimless circles. "How many?" asked Sean. "How many are dead?" 2 more while you were in the water. Altogether 13 in Kosi. "Where's my horse?" "It ran, and I let it go. It will be back at the house." Sean nodded. "Bring them up to the sick paddock. We must watch them for a few days." Sean stood up and started walking back towards the dip tank. Garrick was gone, and the main herd was still in the kraal. Sean opened the gate and turned them loose. He felt better by then, and as his strength returned, with it came his anger and his hatred. He started along the track towards the homestead. His boots squelched as he walked, and he hated Garrick more strongly with each step. Garrick had mixed the dip. Garrick had killed his cattle, and Sean hated him. As Sean came up the slope below the house, he saw Garrick standing in the yard. Garrick saw him also. He disappeared into the kitchen, and Sean started to run. He went in through the kitchen door and nearly knocked down one of the servants. "Garrick!" shouted Sean. "Damn it! Where are you?" He searched the house, once, quickly, and then again thoroughly. Garrick was gone, but the window of their bedroom was open, and there was a dusty boot print on the sill. Garrick had gone over it. "You're a bloody coward!" howled Sean, and scrambled out after him. He stood a second, with his head swinging from side to side, and his fists opening and closing. "I'll find out," he howled again. "I'll find out wherever you're hiding." He started across the yard towards the stables, and halfway there he saw the door of the dairy was closed. When he tried it, he found it was locked from inside. Sean backed away from it, then charged it with his shoulder. The lock burst and the door flew open. Sean skidded across the room and came up against the far wall. Garrick was trying to climb out of the window, but it was small and high up. Sean caught him by the seat of his pants and pulled him down. "What you do to the dip, eh? What you do to it?" he shouted in Garrick's face.
"I didn't mean to. I didn't know it would kill them."
"Tell me what you did."
Sean had hold of the front of his shirt and was dragging him towards the door.
"I didn't do anything. Honest, I didn't know."
"I'm going to hammer you anyway, so you might as well tell me."
"Please, Sean, I didn't know."
Sean jammed Garrick against the doorway and held him there with his left hand. His right hand he drew back with the fist bunched.
"No, Sean, please, no."
And suddenly the anger was gone from Sean. His hand sank back to his sides.
"All right. Just tell me what you did," he said coldly.
His anger was gone, but not his hatred.
"I was tired, and it was getting late, and my leg was hurting," whispered Garrick. "And there was still 4 more tanks to do. I knew you'd check that all the drums were empty, and it was so late, and...
"And?"
"And so I emptied all the dip into the one tank. I didn't know it would kill them. Truly, I didn't."
Sean turned away from him and started walking slowly back towards the house. Garrick stumbled after him.
"I'm sorry, Sean. Honestly, I'm sorry. I didn't know that..."
Sean walked ahead of him into the kitchen and slammed the door in his face. He went through into Waite's study. From the bookshelf,
He lifted down the heavy leather-covered stock register and carried it to the desk. He opened the book, picked up a pen and dipped it. For a moment he stared at the page, and then in the deaths column he wrote the number 13, and after it the words dip poisoning. He pressed down so hard with the pen that the nib cut the paper. It took Sean and the herd boys all the rest of that day and the next to bail out the tank, refill it with clean water, and mix in fresh dip. He saw Garrick only at meals, and they didn't speak. The next day was Sunday. Garrick went into town early, for the church service started at 8 o'clock. When he'd gone, Sean began his preparations. He shaved, leaning close to the mirror and handling the cutthroat gingerly, shaping his sideburns and clearing the hair from the rest of his face until his skin was smooth and fresh-looking. Then he went through to the master bedroom and helped himself to a generous portion of his father's brilliantine, taking care to screw the lid back on the bottle and replace it exactly as he'd found it. He rubbed the brilliantine into his hair and sniffed its perfume appreciatively. He combed his hair over his forehead, parted it down the centre, and polished it into a gloss with Waite's silver-backed brushes. Then a clean white shirt, breeches worn only once before, boots as shiny as his hair, and Sean was ready. The clock on the mantelpiece in the lounge assured him that he was well ahead of time. To be exact, he was 2 hours early. 8 o'clock now. Church didn't end until 9, and it would be another hour before Anna could escape from under the eyes of her family and reach the rendezvous above the falls. He settled down to wait. He read the latest copy of The Natal Farmer. He had read it 3 times, for it was a month old, but now even the excellent article on stomach parasites in cattle and sheep had lost much of its punch. Sean's attention wandered. He thought about the day ahead and felt the familiar movement within his breeches. This necessitated a rearrangement, for the breeches were tight-fitting. Then fantasy palled. Sean was a doer, not a thinker, and he went through to the kitchen to solicit a cup of coffee from Joseph. When he'd finished it, there was still 30 minutes to go. "The hell with it," said Sean, and shouted for his horse. He climbed the escarpment, letting his horse move diagonally up the slope, and at the top he dismounted and let it blow. Today he could see the course of the Tugela River out across the plain. It was a belt of dark green. He could count the roofs of the houses in Ladyburg, and the church spire, copper-clad, shone in the sunlight, like a beacon fire. He mounted again and rode along the edge of the plateau until he reached the Baboon Stream above the falls. He followed it back and forded it at a shallow place, lifting his feet up on the saddle in front of him to keep his boots dry. He off-saddled next to the pools and knee-haltered his horse. Then he followed the path until it dropped over the edge of the plateau into the thick forest that surrounded the falls. It was cool and damp in the forest, with moss growing on the trees, for the roof of leaves and creepers shut out the sun. There was a bottle bird in the undergrowth. Glug, 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 it said, like water poured from a bottle, and its call was almost drowned in the ceaseless thunder of the falls. Sean spread his handkerchief on a rock beside the path, sat down on it and waited. Within 5 minutes he was fidgeting impatiently. Within 30 minutes he was grumbling aloud. "I'll count to 500. If she hasn't come by then, I'm not going to wait."
He counted, and when he reached the promised figure, he stopped and peered anxiously down the path. There was no sign of Anna. "I'm not going to sit here all day," he announced, and made no effort to stand up. A fat yellow caterpillar caught his eye. It was on the trunk of a tree further down the slope. He picked up a pebble and threw it. It bounced off the tree an inch above the caterpillar. "Close," Sean encouraged himself, and stooped for another stone. After a while, he had exhausted the supply of pebbles around his feet, and the caterpillar was still moving leisurely up the trunk. Sean was forced to go out on a foraging expedition for more pebbles. He came back with both hands full and once more took up his position on the rock. He piled the pebbles between his feet and reopened the bombardment. He aimed each throw with the utmost concentration, and with his third pebble he hit squarely, and the caterpillar popped in a spurt of green juice. Sean felt cheated. He looked around for a new target, and instead found Anna standing beside him.
"Hello, Sean."
She had on a pink dress. She carried her shoes in one hand and a small basket in the other.
"I brought some lunch for us."
"What took you so long?" Sean stood up and wiped his hands on his breeches. "I thought you weren't coming."
"I'm sorry. Everything went wrong."
There was an awkward pause, and Anna flushed slightly as Sean looked at her. Then she turned and started up the path.
"Come on, I'll race you to the top."
She ran fast on bare feet, holding her skirts up to her knees, and she was out in the sunshine before Sean caught her. He put his arms around her from behind, and they fell together into the grass beside the path. They lay holding each other, laughing and panting at the same time.
"The service went on and on. I thought it would never finish," said Anna. "And afterwards..."
Before she could finish, Sean covered her mouth with his, and immediately her arms came up around his neck. They kissed with the tension building up steadily between them until Anna was moaning softly and moving her body against his. Sean released her mouth and moved his lips down across her cheek to her neck.
"Oh, Sean, it's been so long. It's been a whole week."
"I know.
I've missed you so. I thought about you every day."
Sean had his face pressed into her neck. He didn't answer.
"Did you miss me, Sean?"
Sean murmured, and lifted his mouth to take the lobe of her ear between his teeth.
"Did you think about me while you were working?" "Tell me properly, Sean. Say it properly."
"I missed you, Anna. I thought about you all the time," lied Sean, and kissed her on the mouth. She clung to him, and Sean's hand went down, right down to her knee, then up again under her clothes. Anna caught his wrist and held his hand away.
"No, Sean, just kiss me."
Sean waited until her grip relaxed, and then tried again, but this time she twisted away from him and sat up.
"Sometimes I think that's all you want to do."
Sean felt his anger coming up, but he had the good sense to check it.
"That's not true, Anna. It's just that I haven't seen you for so long, and I've missed you so much."
She softened immediately and reached out to touch his cheek.
"Oh, Sean, I'm sorry. I didn't mind, really. It's just that... oh, I don't know."
She scrambled to her feet and picked up the basket.
"Come on, let's go on to the pools."
They had a special place. It was walled in by the reeds and shaded by a big tree that grew on the bank above. The sand was washed clean and white. Sean spread his saddle blanket for them to sit on. They could hear the river close by, but hidden, and the reeds rustled and nodded their fluffy heads with each breath of the wind.
and I couldn't get rid of him,"
Anna chattered as she knelt on the blanket and unpacked the basket.
"He just sat there, and every time I said something he blushed and wriggled on his seat. In the end I just told him, 'I'm sorry, Gary, I have to go.'"
Sean scowled. The mention of Garrick had reminded him of the dip. He hadn't forgiven him yet.
"And then, when I got into the house, I found that Pa and Fricky were fighting. Ma was in tears, and the other kids were locked in the bedroom."
"Who won?" asked Sean with interest.
"They weren't really fighting. They were just shouting at each other. They were both drunk."
Sean was always slightly shocked at Anna's casual reference to her family's drinking habits. Everybody knew about Mr. Van Essen and his two eldest boys, but Anna didn't have to talk about it. Once Sean had tried to correct her. "You shouldn't say things like that about your pa. You should respect him." And Anna had looked at him calmly and asked, "Why?" Which was a difficult question. But now she changed the subject.
"Do you want to eat yet?"
"No," said Sean, and reached for her. She fought back, shrieking demurely, until Sean held her down and kissed her. Then she lay quietly answering his kisses.
"If you stop me now, I'm going to go mad," whispered Sean, and deliberately unfastened the top button of her dress.
She watched his face with solemn eyes, and her hand stayed on his shoulders until he'd undone her blouse down to the waist, and then with her fingers she traced the bold black curves of his eyebrows.
"No, Sean, I won't stop you. I want to as well. I want to as much as you do."
There was so much to discover, and each thing was strange and wonderful, and they were the first to find it. The way the muscles stood out down the side of his chest beneath his arms, and yet left a place where she could see the outline of his ribs. The texture of her skin, smooth and white, with a faint blue suggestion of veins underneath. The deep hollow down the centre of his back. Pressing her fingers into it, she could feel his spine. The down on her cheeks, so pale and fine, he could see it only in the sunlight. The way their lips felt against each other, and the tiny flutter of tongues between. The smell of their bodies, one milky warm, and the other musky and vigorous. The hair that covered his chest and grew thicker under his arms and hers, startlingly dark against white skin, a small silky nest of it. Each time there was something new to find and greet with soft sounds of delight. Now kneeling before her, as she lay with her head thrown back and her arms half raised to receive him, Sean suddenly bowed his head and touched her with his mouth. The taste of her was clean as the taste of the sea. Her eyes flew open.
"Sean, no, you mustn't. Oh, no, you mustn't."
There were lips within lips, and a bud as softly resilient as a tiny green grape. Sean found it with the tip of his tongue.
"Oh, Sean, you can't do that. Please. Please."
And her hands were in the thick hair at the back of his head, holding him there.
"I can't stand it any more. Come over me quickly, quickly, Sean."
Feeling like a sail in a hurricane, swollen and hard and tight, stretched beyond its limit until it burst and was blown to shreds in the wind and was gone. Everything gone. The wind and the sail, the tension and the wanting, all gone. There was left only the great nothingness, which is peace. Perhaps a kind of death. Perhaps death is like that. But like death, not an ending, for even death contains the seeds of resurrection.
So they came back from peace to a new beginning, slowly at first, and then faster, until there were two people again. Two people on a blanket among reeds, with the sunlight white on the sand between them.
It's better. Each time it's better and better, isn't it, Sean?
Ah, Sean stretched, arching his back and spreading his arms.
Sean, you do love me, don't you?
Sure. Sure I love you.
I think you must love me to have done, she hesitated, to do what you did.
I just said so, didn't I?
Sean's attention wandered to the basket. He selected an apple and polished it on the blanket.
Tell me properly. Hold me tight and tell me.
Hell, Anna, how many times have I got to say it?
Sean bit into the apple.
Did you bring any of your Ma's shortbread?
It was coming on night when Sean got back to Thithuna's corral. He turned his horse over to one of the grooms and went into the house. His body tingled from the sun, and he felt the emptiness and sadness of after love. But it was a good sadness, like the sadness of old memories. Garrick was in the dining room eating alone. Sean walked into the room and Garrick looked up nervously.
Hello, Gary.
Sean smiled at him, and Garrick was momentarily dazzled by it. Sean sat down in the chair beside him and punched him lightly on the arm.
Have you left any for me?
His hatred was gone.
There's plenty, Garrick nodded eagerly. Try some of the potatoes. They're jolly good.